and how they monetize their niche music by engaging a global audience and producing a wide variety of content across different media and different platforms, both through traditional media products such as records, live concerts and music videos, but also documentary films, collaborations with symphony orchestras, and even a music education program. All of these activities, they add distinct dimensions to the storytelling about who FDA Klang is. But the activities are simultaneously tied together through an overarching sonic and visual profile. Some of the activities engage audiences in activities that weave FDA Klang into the social fabric of their life in a dialectical relationship where music is used to construct and express the personal identity of audiences. And at the same time, it adds value attached to the band and their music. The presentation is not meant as a hagiography of FDA Klang, but as a case study of how musicians can effectively utilize some of the opportunities that are offered in the new media ecology for marketing niche music. I'll draw on an interdisciplinary theoretical framework, including theories of media convergence, transmedia storytelling, and cultural labor. And I'll suggest understanding independent musicians as entrepreneurial producers of media content, and show how musicians employ strategies that could actually be said to be similar to the branding strategies of marketers from other industries when they add value to their music and build a loyal fan base. Creating their music as transmedia stories, FDA Klang effectively integrates these efforts into their art, whereby they simultaneously market their music and facilitate a business model based on a diversity of revenue streams. So, in the title I have the concept of transmedia storytelling. So just a very brief, what is transmedia storytelling? It's a concept introduced by media scholar Henry Jenkins in 2003. And according to Jenkins, transmedia storytelling represents a process where integral elements of a fiction gets dispersed systematically across multiple delivery channels for the purpose of creating a unified and coordinated entertainment experience. Ideally, each medium makes its own unique contribution to the unfolding of the story. So, for example, in the Matrix franchise, key bits of information are conveyed through three live action films, a series of animated shorts, two collection of comic book stories, and several video games. There is no single urtext where one can turn to gain all the information needed to comprehend the Matrix universe. So, in this way, transmedia storytelling is not merely an adaption of content from one media to another. Each channel ideally functions as a unique entry point to the narrative universe, and each text is ideally accessible on its own terms, adding to the comprehension of the overall narrative. However, the individual narrative parts are not dependent on each other to be comprehensible. So, each part can be engaged together or separately. And in this way, users can engage more or less with media text according to how much they're invested in the overall narrative without experiencing the narrative as redundant on one side or obscure on the other side. In order to function this way, transmedia stories are often based on not based on a specific plot, but rather on complex fictional worlds, which can contain multiple interrelated stories. Transmedia storytelling as a concept relies on two emerging tendencies in new media ecology. On one hand, it reflects the tendency towards conglomeration and vertical integration in the media industry companies. Transmedia storytelling makes it possible to exploit a strong cultural brand across media platforms and customer segments. So in that sense, it's quite a commercial concept. But on the other hand, it relies heavily on the eroding barriers between media channels that is a result of media convergence. And one of the main drivers in convergence culture, according to Jenkins, is the new, more active role of the user in gathering, curating, remixing, and disseminating media text across different media platforms, as some of us heard in the presentation earlier this morning. In that sense, the concept of transmedia storytelling integrates commercial and artistic perspectives. Some questions arise from this concept, primarily connected to the fact that that transmedia storytelling comes out of a movie context and a literature context. So when we move on to wanting to describe music, music isn't primarily concerned with delivering a grand narrative. Even though songs, music videos, and even albums may have narrative character, the only recurring narrative is usually located at the level of the artist's persona. So how does transmedia storytelling transfer to a context where narratives is concerned with the identity and authenticity of one or more persons rather than fictional characters and plots? Secondly, the concept has until now primarily been used as in connection to movies, TV, literature, and so on. So how do we transfer it to music? And especially, how do we transfer it to music where there's not these big production budgets as we see in Hollywood movie making? I'll try to explore some of these questions now, drawing on my studies of the Danish band Efterklang. And just a short introduction of who Efterklang is. This is Efterklang. It's a trio from Copenhagen in Denmark. In some sense, they're just an ordinary experimental alternative band. They release records, they do music videos, and they play concerts. But because they play niche music, there isn't that big a market for that in Denmark, being a small country. So they didn't have a chance to get signed to a record company because of industry textures. Danish major companies would have to sell up to their mother companies in larger countries, in main markets, and they're usually not that successful at doing that. So niche bands in Denmark are having quite a hard time. So they established their own record label, Rumraket, releasing their first EPs in Scandinavia, and eventually some bigger independent record companies thought they were interesting and signed them. Right now they're signed to 4AD, who releases the music internationally, but while they're still retaining control of Scandinavia on their own record label. What I'll concentrate on in this context is the album, their most recent album, Pyramida. And I want to show you just a short video snippet from the trailer they released on YouTube announcing that they would be releasing this album. They went to an abandoned mining, Russian mining town on the Norwegian island of Spitsbergen, which is 400 miles north of the most northern off the coast of Norway. So and they gathered sounds there in this abandoned mining city, a mining town, and they took them home, processed them, and used them in making music. What they did with the music was, of course, they made some songs, and they didn't only release those songs. They actually world premiered the album in Sydney Opera House with the symphony orchestra there. So the first performance of these songs were with the symphony orchestra, adding a new layer to this. And 2 months after premiering the album, they premiered a documentary about the making of the album. But the documentary is not only about the making of the album, it's just as much about the history of the mining town where they went to gather sounds for this album. So it weaves into each other perspectives of the history of this town, the story about the band collecting sounds for making for making their album, and visually it's so appealing that it might even be considered as just an hour-long music video for the Afterclang music. They premiered it at a documentary film festival, and they toured it for some documentary film festivals, winning a couple of prizes. They screened it at art house cinemas, and then 2 months later, they released it at what they called private public screenings. A private public screening is a place where audiences can sign up to screen the film in wherever they like. They had people screening it in auditoriums, cafes, galleries, and people's living rooms, basements, dormitories, and so on. There was very simple principles. It had to be public. It had to be open. People had to be able to just come and about. It had to be free, and it had to have a minimum capacity of 5 persons. They announced this on their social media, and what happened was that people signed up. Actually, during 3 months, they ended up with more than 800 screenings all around the world for this. And people sent in pictures from their screenings, which they then posted at on their Flickr account, of all these audiences from all around the world sitting in their own living rooms watching this documentary about Afterclang. Now, the popular music artist has long been regarded as the central figure in understanding meaning and value in musical works. And music, as Keith Iger says, music is understood and interpreted as being motivated, authored, and intentionally created by musicians, and this understanding is shared by fans, journalists, and scholars alike. The effect of this is that we understand individual songs in relation to our knowledge of the performer, as it is depicted through media narratives, as well as in relation to other works by the artists. In that respect, the notion of the auteur is the locus of meaning and value of the music. But the audience perception of the auteur is mediated through the artist's persona. In the case of Afterclang, the media texts frame the band persona through different devices, through collaboration with visual artists, both graphic designers and art film directors. I'll get back to the graphic designers in a while. And symphony orchestras, they establish a connection to serious art worlds. Through documentaries, and there was also a radio montage about this this trip, interviews, they tell a story about who they are as individuals and how they create their music. And through private public screenings and intensive touring, they convey a notion of a band that is at eye level with their fans. In that way, the notion that popular music is often understood in relation to the artist's persona, it's not new, but the deliberate and controlled communication of artistic persona with consistent visual and sonic profile across multiple media has usually been connected to stars like Madonna, more than niche musicians like Afterclang. The reason for this has primarily been the difficult access to traditional broadcast and print media, and insufficient funds to make these media productions. However, these impediments have been minimized by the so-called democratization caused by the technological development. This enables a band like Afterclang to act as media producers rather than just being musicians. But the diversity not only adds to the monetization of music in line with what Jenkins notes about the Matrix, the diversity in media text leads to a situation where there's no real text to the Afterclang universe. Each of these media texts can be understood on their own, or they can be additively combined in a multitude of combinations, depending on the taste, interests, and engagements of the individual fans. Furthermore, Afterclang taps into the community building potential of convergence culture by providing fans with media texts that invite sharing. These include more conventional texts, such as online streaming of music videos and live performances, but also tie into the more tight social connections in offline life through these private public screenings. As noted earlier, music is not usually conceived to be primarily concerned with delivering a grand narrative evolving around fictional characters and plots, and this also holds true for Afterclang. Even though Pyramida has been connected to the narrative of its conception, there is no underlying narrative running through all the media texts. There is no reference to Pyramida, to the town and the way they gathered sounds for the album in the song lyrics or something like that. So they're individual and autonomous in that respect. Instead, Afterclang rely on two factors in creating a consistent transmedia universe. First, an overarching visual and sonic profile to frame every media product. And in order to achieve this, they deliberately retain a great deal of control of both graphical and musical production. I'll just show you the graphical production. They have collaborated with a design duo for most of their career. So this is the first EP cover. When it folds out, you have this universe here. This is the cover for their second album, which also was used the same graphic design was used for the music video, the first music video for that production. When they went on tour, they had a stage design that looks like this. Some of the concert on that tour was in collaboration with a symphony orchestra, and when they released the cover for a live recording of that and a DVD, it looked like this. A lot of the color schemes go through to the next album release, which is called Magic Chairs, 2 years later. And we can see the color schemes again going on to these screenshots and press photos from their most recent release. All of these graphical productions, along with the graphic design of posters and end credits for the film, is designed by this graphic design duo. Also, for this production Pyramida, we see that there are some design elements going through it. We have the triangle, we have the circle, we have the dotted lines. This is from the album cover. This is a screenshot from the movie, and this is from the stage design from premiering the concerts with the Sydney Symphony Orchestra. Good. We're moving on to monetization. Another aspect of transmedia storytelling is the ability to monetize on the band identity. Being a niche band like Afterclang is often conceptualized as being a part of the long tail of the music industry made possible by digital distribution. And one often cited opposition against the business model of the long tail is that it might well create profit for aggregators like record companies and music services. But for the individual artist, the long tail just increases the number of competitors, making it harder for each to make a living. On the other hand, it has been argued that the increased connectivity and decreased cost of production and distribution has made it possible for artists to create a substantial income from just, Kevin Kelly says, a thousand true fans. Although this perspective might be bringing matters to a head, it highlights the fact that some music fans are willing to spend more than just the price of CD on experiences and products connected to their favorite artists. The challenge is to have offerings that meet the demands of fans, spanning from the ones who merely stream the music on a streaming service to the super fans that travel to foreign cities to attend concerts and collect special edition releases, t-shirts, posters, and to contain all of these possibilities within a single artistic universe. The transmedia storytelling of Efterklang has two effects that potentially impact monetization of their music. On the one hand, it creates multiple entrance points to the artistic universe. It is possible to discover the band through hearing the music, seeing a film at a film festival, being invited to your friend's house for a private public screening, hearing a radio montage about the creation of the album, by going to a concert, or discovering the visual universe of their music videos, or even reading about their artwork on graphic design blogs or magazines. On the other hand, it makes it possible to offer a variety of products for sale. Apart from music in both physical and digital formats, fans are offered different concert formats. They tour as a six-piece band, as a trio, and with symphony orchestras. They can attend official film screenings, buy DVDs, t-shirts, posters, and so on. Furthermore, the transmedial approach affords opportunities for simultaneously tapping into multiple revenue streams that are usually not available to musicians from niche music, at least not niche popular music. These include commissions from symphony orchestras, royalties from film screenings, and production support from the Danish Film Institute, Arts Council, and National TV. However, this transition from being a musician to being a producer of media texts in a wider sense obviously influenced the character of the labor performed by the band. It has been pointed out that the democratization of music production and distribution in the wake of the digital revolution has increased pressure on musicians to act maybe involuntarily as independent entrepreneurs with responsibility for communication and business strategies. In the case of Efterklang, the band has taken this step to the fullest by a clear division of labor. One of the three band members does not contribute to songwriting and only sparingly plays instruments on the records. His creative role instead is to act as a manager and coordinate all of these transmedial productions. So although the music is the core of Efterklang identity, the band considered the paratext as an integral part of their creative expression. This prioritization is reflected in the fact that the band retains control over musical productions, as well as being executive producers, in the meaning used in the film industry, of graphic design and video production. However, they include fans in the construction of community. Especially in the case of the private public screenings of documentaries, Efterklang enters into a dialogic relationship with their fans, where the fans invest their own personal identity in hosting screenings of the film. On one hand, this functions as a strong recommendation of the band and their music to peers, but on the other hand, it grants fans a sense of mutual engagement with the band that can be rewarding in itself, as well as add to the social esteem of the fan hosting the screen. The effect of this kind of inclusion of fans has been that Efterklang sell more concert tickets than albums. According to the band, this is due to the fact that part of the audience come to the concert, as they did also to the private public screenings, on the recommendation of their friends. In this way, the band effectively draw on the labor of the fans in marketing their music, and by having built small but very engaged and loyal fan bases in many regions of the world, they are able to tour so intensively that they can actually make a living from their niche music. That's it from me. Thank you.
So we've got 10 minutes or so for questions. I'll start with just a little comment. I was really glad that you acknowledged that a lot of these strategies have traditionally been in the realm of much greater, more successful artists, or people who traditionally have had access to the promotional and marketing machine of the major labels, because, and this is seen almost in a sense of a kind of like reverse type of appropriation, because I think often we tend to associate, especially with niche musics and indie musics, that the appropriation happens the other way, you know, that the mainstream sort of appropriates what's hip and what's happening on the ground and then translates that into something else. And I think, you know, this it's certainly in line a little bit with with Jenkins's rendering of this, right, where there's this kind of idea that there's somehow now a seizing of control, right, or a dispersion or a decentralization of control. I'm just wondering if in your research, it's one thing to start to apply these types of ideas to people that I think we can, or artists that I think we can say, okay, I'd like to support them. Clearly, they're not going to make a lot of money and things like that. But then you see the other side of this, you know, the sort of mass tweeting and, you know, like, you know, I teach a lot of students and some of them have actually reported that they tweet on behalf of celebrities and things like this. So I'm wondering if within your larger research project, if you're looking at this sort of disconnect just in the way the audiences actually relate to the different sort of levels of success that the artists might have.
Well, After Clank are very, when I talk to them, they're very deliberate about how they use the social media. They wanted to be very clear that they are talking and that's not the other way around. So you could say that they're trying to seize control, and in some way they're actually trying to reverse a lot of the mechanisms that we've seen earlier from the music industry, where we see musicians as exploited by record companies. They, even though they've signed to not a major label, but 4AD is a quite big label, they still retain control of their all their creative, as well as a lot of their commercial value. They use them as service providers in that aspect.
And so I'm assuming that the fans, that like they're explicit about this, and the fans are sort of support that type of, I guess, you know, politicization of their activity.
They in some aspects they do actually tell about that aspect. But you can also just understand After Clank without knowing about that aspect. And maybe the paradoxical thing about After Clank in this case is that they're actually controlling a lot of their production, and where what is the mantra of music industry would be to let audiences in and release control. They're actually very possessive about their music. No one, they don't want to do remix projects because it sounds bad. So actually they retain a lot of control, and they actually have success doing that because that's some of the way it connects with their audience.
Mm-hmm. Yes? I was thinking about this while you're talking. I kept thinking about artist after artist from like the Scandinavian country, specifically in Iceland, that sort of do this own self-promotions, especially like Ólafur Val, mm-hmm. He released an album that he recorded a song in his living room every day of the week, and after recording that song, he'd throw that video online. And he's really good with social media, just when he's recording an album, doing a live stream at the time, always trying to get like people engaged. So I was wondering, is this sort of marketing something that's really common for a lot of these Scandinavian countries because they're so small that this is your way to kind of like branch out to larger audiences?
I think it has a lot to do with being small nations. With small musical industries, so what happens is Rasmus, who is the manager slash band member of the band, he knows almost anyone in the Danish music industry, just from being at the networking opportunities, using them. So they had a way to connect with the media outlets, even though they were small, and I think that. But even though he knew them, and even though people saw that he was onto something, there simply isn't a market for that kind of music in Denmark that's big enough to sustain a band like that, and to give a return on investment for the record company. So even though people saw that they were onto something, they couldn't do anything. And major companies who would traditionally be the ones who had the opportunity to sell upwards in their own organization, they don't have a lot of success with selling Scandinavian bands upwards. So I think what we see in Denmark with bands like After Clank and also in Iceland is that people are trying to go around the mainstream market of their native countries to try to make an international network, and they do that better themselves than the major companies can do for them.
Because like really, sorry.
Okay.
I was going to say, like, you can look at Cigarettes, for example, where they really started very small and very niche music and started doing this self-promotion and then became absolutely huge. But if you're kind of wondering, like, how much of it is still, like, themselves, not their part of this major record, like, well, that's where really why.
There's a lot of parallels to Sigur Rós, definitely, in FFM. Yeah.
In North America, we've seen really innovative artists who have managed to break through and be able to become sustain themselves within the record label and gain some control within the recording industry, then attempt to turn around, and when they see good artists, help to pull them up through the ranks and, you know, kind of protect them and say, like, you know, I see something within you. Are Scandinavian artists also attempting to do that as well?
Definitely. After Clang, they started their own record company, but they started releasing other artists. But actually, they released a couple of Scandinavian artists, but they also released a band like Grizzly Bear for the Scandinavian market before they were big there. So actually, for 2 years, or for two tours of Denmark, Grizzly Bear was actually, warming up? They were opening the show for After Clang on a Danish tour back in 2004, 2006, I think. So they do that. They have this investment in bringing other artists with them when they have connection.
Well, if we don't have any more questions, thanks, Rasmus.
Thank you.